All right, good morning. Welcome to the last week. And let me briefly review what we were doing on Friday. So we basically started, you know, using the ADS CFT to tell us something about real physics. And namely, what we were interested in is basically the physics of quark-gluon plasma. And of course, quark-gluon plasma described the state of matter in the early universe. So, you know, very, very shortly after the Big Bang, so something like 10 to minus 6, 10 to minus 6 seconds, that's where you, when you would find this kind of matter in our universe. And at the time, the universe was very hot, so this is about, you know, 10 to 13 Kelvin or something like that. And then, of course, as it was getting colder and colder, the quarks got confined, and you know, we don't see this matter in the usual situation anymore. So now, this physics, this QFT, is strongly coupled, okay, but of course it is not a CFT. So strictly speaking, you cannot use ADS CFT to describe this. You have to use this generalized version of ADS CFT. You have to use this, you know, gauge gravity duality, which is more general and less proven even. So even ADS CFT is not proven, but we are going beyond that, and we are using gauge gravity duality, which is not proven either. Right, but so certainly what you can do is that you can recreate this quark-gluon plasma, and it was done in Large Hadron Collider. And what was found is that, you know, this thing here sort of behaves like it was in hydro regime. So you can really describe it like with hydrodynamics. And one thing which people could measure about this quark-gluon plasma was precisely this shear viscosity, which we know what it is. For normal fluids, and what they actually found by the actual measurement is that, you know, the shear viscosity versus the entropy density is something like 1 over 4 pi. Okay, and so that was what was found in LHC, and the question is, can you theoretically reproduce this result? And I don't think you can really do it in the QFT side, but what people were able to do is that they were able to reproduce something like this through the ADS CFT correspondence. Okay, so that's one of the big victories of ADS CFT correspondence, and something that you should really be noted as a, you know, great success of this thing. So now, okay, so I would like to drive you through the calculation of eta over s. Of course, we don't have time to do all the work, but we have done some already in your tutorial last week. And so I just want to give you a recipe, what needs to be done, and you will see that basically you have all the tools. And you can really do and do the calculation yourself if you want to spend a couple of days doing it. Okay? So how does it go? So first of all, let me tell you what this hydrodynamics really is. And hydrodynamics is an effective field theory describing long range, meaning if you go to the Fourier space, the corresponding momenta go to zero. Low energy, the frequency goes to zero. Fluctuations about equilibrium. Right? So basically what it means is that I have very, very slowly varying things, and always locally, if I zoom on, you know, things locally, I can describe it by a local, I have a local equilibrium. I can describe this by temperature and stuff like that, is if I were in equilibrium. But then if I move further away, then finally this temperature will depend on where I am in the plasma and so on. And so roughly speaking, this will be true if the, you know, the fluctuations, which we consider the corresponding wavelength, is much, much bigger than mean free path length, which is characteristic. So if you have collisions of the particles, and you know, the particle cannot go very, very far, it just bumps into another particle, I can establish local equilibrium, and so this will be a good regime, good description when this is true. So now the dynamics of these things is simply described by the conservation of the energy momentum tensor. So you describe your fluid by the energy momentum tensor and the dynamics of the fluid are described by the conservation. So now here, of course, this thing here establishes d number of equations of motion, but you have many more components of the t mean u. And so basically, you have to reduce the number of components, of the t mean u to d. And so what people typically traditionally choose is that the things which describe our plasma will be temperature, which is a function of x, and will be the velocity of the fluid, which is a function of x. But u squared is minus 1, so this is precisely d unknowns, and you are solving your d equations for these d unknowns. So this is a well-posed system. So this is also d unknowns. And you can solve that system. However, what it means is that you have to express your t mu nu, which has d times d plus 1 over 2 components, only in terms of d components. And this is done through the constitutive relations. So you write the t mu nu constitutive relations. And so you write it in terms of this t and u mu, right? You write it only in terms of these d components here. And so in practice, what it means is that you will describe your t mu nu in terms of quantities like, well, the energy density, which will be a function of temperature, pressure, which will be a function of temperature, and so on. But then you also have the transport coefficients. So these guys here are called transport coefficients. Transport coefficients, and one of them will be the shear viscosity, one of them will be the bulk viscosity, and so on. And all these, And so these will be some God-given parameters which describe the properties of your fluid. And so your theory here is a macroscopic theory, right? So we are just thinking about this as a, you know, macroscopically. And so these things here cannot be really, you know, derived within the realms of hydrodynamics. So somebody has to give you what is the viscosity for that fluid. And then once you know that, you can start doing calculation in hydrodynamics. Okay, so these are God-given. And you know that means that they cannot be derived within this theory. That's something that's an external input, right? Okay. Okay. And so how does this t mu nu really in practice looks like? Is that what you do is that you do a derivative expansion. So things are very, very slowly varying. And so if you start thinking about the derivatives of things, they are even more slowly varying. So basically adding more and more derivatives corresponds to something like taking adding terms which are of the order of lambda mean free path divided by lambda fluctuations to the corresponding power, which corresponds to the number of derivatives you have in your derivative expansion. Okay, so we have the derivative expansion for t mu nu. And of course, the first term which has no derivatives whatsoever will be the perfect fluid. Okay, so that you already know from GR course or whatever. So t mu nu will be the perfect fluid form, rho plus p u mu u nu plus p that we call the metric gamma mu nu. I'll probably call it. So that's the perfect fluid. And it has zeros order. So there are no derivatives here. Okay. But then you go beyond the perfect fluid. But of course, here, so rho is a function of temperature, p is a function of temperature, right? But temperature is a function of x. So all these quantities here, rho, p, u, and whatever, are function of x. They vary throughout your fluid of your hydro regime. And then you have the first perturbation containing the first derivatives. So this is the first. And then you have the terms which are of the order lambda mean free path divided by lambda fluctuation. O, I think square or something like that, right? So this is how the derivative expansion really works for you. And so what we'll do is that we'll just do the simplest thing. So we will go beyond the zeroth order, we'll go to the first order, as you have done in your tutorial, right? And so then the question is how the tau mu nu looks like in the first order. And the answer is it's not unique. It depends on what kind of gauge you are choosing. And there are a lot of popular gauges. You can write down your hydrodynamic equations. One of them is called Landau's gauge. Okay. So now, so this guy is actually gauge dependent. But the question is, like, do all the gauges give you the same physics, right? So that's the main question. And if you do it properly, they do. So it doesn't matter which one you use. Okay, so in Landau's gauge, and what is Landau's gauge is basically you demand that the full T mu nu times U nu is related to the energy density. Okay, so this is something you would expect. So this is what you are imposing to construct the Landau's gauge, and so in this gauge, the tau mu nu takes the following form. It's whatever you've seen already in your tutorial. So it's 2 eta sigma mu nu minus 2 zeta theta p mu nu. Okay, so this is how the tau mu nu looks like. And you know how the splitting is done here before I write what it is. So this guy, tau mu nu, has to be a symmetric tensor. It's an energy momentum tensor, it's symmetric. And what you are really doing here is you are doing a decomposition of symmetric matrices into the trace phi part and the trace. So this will be the trace part, and this is the trace phi part. Question?
What is the physical meaning of this? Of the gauge? Does it mean that if I have a particle moving along a warp line, my current along the warp line is what I expect it to be, like density times velocity?
I'm trying to recall what it means. I better say nothing now, but okay, I'll say something which is very wrong. So typically what you can choose is, well, there will be some currents in your fluid. There will be some flows of the entropy, flows of the energy, and stuff like that. So here, you are really preferring somehow the flow of the energy. So this is so this thing here is like the flow of the energy, right? And so you are centering your attention on the flow of energy, but there are other choices. You can follow the flow of entropy or flow of current or stuff like that. I think that's correct, but probably not. So forget about it, okay? So we can read about Landau's gauge. Yeah. Okay, so we have this decomposition, the standard decomposition, where this guy is the shear viscosity. This guy is the bulk viscosity, and that corresponds to this trace part. But what you have shown in your tutorial is that if you demand that this describes CFT, then the bulk viscosity has to be zero. Okay, zeta equals to zero for CFT. Of course, quark-gluon plasma is not CFT, so it won't be zero there necessarily, but it will probably be close to zero. I'm not sure if they could measure it, probably not, but I don't know. Okay, so anyway, so the CFT prediction is that this thing here is not there. Okay, so finally, what is the sigma mu nu? So sigma mu nu is equal to, and oh no, let me put alpha beta, so that I don't screw it up. It's P alpha gamma P beta delta. And then I told you that it's one derivative. So we'll have a derivative acting on U gamma, lambda gamma U delta symmetrized. And then minus, and that's the formula which you have seen in your tutorial, P gamma delta theta. Where theta is the divergence of the velocity, gamma, and p is the projector perpendicular to the velocity. Okay, so this is what you get in the first order in this particular gauge. Okay, so now we understand hydrodynamics. So this is what should describe our quark gluon plasma. So let's now see how do we calculate this eta over s. Okay. So now we want to calculate eta over s. And the statement is we will do it in three steps. So step number one, and that is precisely to use this hydrodynamic description. So use use hydro description, which is where, after all, we know what the viscosity is. So this would correspond to macroscopic physics. Macroscopic physics. Okay. And you have done the calculation in the tutorial. What you have to do is that, what I told you to do is that, let's say we put the fluid in some curved space-time, where there's this curve metric gamma mu nu, right? So now let's consider specific form of the gamma mu nu, where basically where our metric is the flat metric, but it has a perturbation in the x and y direction. So there will be some non-trivial h, x, and y, as you had in the tutorial. And then this perturbation of the metric induces the perturbation in your energy momentum tensor tau mu nu. And we only want such a perturbation which depends on our viscosity, right? So that we can extract it by knowing what the perturbation in the metric is, we can extract the perturbation of the energy momentum tensor. Okay, so what you have done is that you have calculated delta tau xy, which was the interesting perturbation of the energy momentum tensor, and you have derived in your tutorial 5, that this is equal to, in the Fourier space, minus I omega h x y 0. Okay, so if we do the perturbation, so this is the if we do the perturbation of the geometry in the x and y direction, that gives us the perturbation of the energy momentum tensor. And I forgot the most important thing is that it depends on this shear viscosity, eta h x y 0. Okay, so very good. So now how we can. So this is the macroscopic change in the energy momentum tensor. It's precisely that energy momentum tensor over here, right? And this is what you have derived. And this guy here is some fictitious gravitational field, which manages actually the change of our tau. Managing of tau xy. Okay? So you can think about it. So it could be a real gravitational field. If you had plasma around the star somewhere in the universe in curved space, then if you could manage that the star is inducing some non-trivial hxy, then there will be the corresponding physical change in tau xy. But you can also think about, well, I really want to calculate this guy here, so I make up some, you know, fictitious gravitational field hxy, so that, you know, this is true. But the important thing is that it does depend on this eta over here.
Sorry, I'm misunderstanding the physical interpretation of this formula. So what's delta t? Delta t is the perturbation of the stress tensor?
Exactly.
But in what sense are we? Like, there is the mathematical sense in which we introduce this fictitious gravitational field.
Yeah.
But what are we trying to measure from the fluid by doing this delta? Like, what is delta?
Sorry. So what you are doing here is that you say, well, my gamma mu nu is some fixed background, let's say flat metric, where my CFT, QFT layers and stuff like that. right? But then I do a small perturbation of this. And if I do a small perturbation of this gravitational field in the background, it induces some change in the energy momentum tensor of my fluid, right? What is important for us is that this change does depend on the shear viscosity. And so in principle, if we know what this is and we know what that is, we can calculate the eta from here, right? So it's just a mathematical trick if you want, but it makes sense, right? So you can do it in real situation. I start tuning on somehow very cleverly the gravitational field, right? And I'll see the response of my QFT, right? And then I can calculate the eta from there, right? So why not? In principle, right? You are theoreticians. I don't know how you would do that in practice. Okay, so that's step one, number one. Now, step number two. Okay, and so what you want to do now is that you want to relate this macroscopic things to the microscopic physics. Okay, so to relate this to microscopic physics, we use something which is called, linear response theory. Now, this is something you might have seen in your QFT course or in statistical physics course or whatever. It would take me two lectures to actually give you all the details. So let's not give you all the details. Let's just give you what the result is, okay? But it's what you are doing is that you are just doing a perturbation theory in quantum mechanics or, you know, whatever. So what this thing is doing is that, let's say I have a perturbation. So assume system in equilibrium. Okay, and so this is described by some density matrix rho zero or whatever, right? And now you perturb that system in equilibrium with some external field or external source. Perturbed. By external source. Phi zero, okay? So then the question is, so what you are really doing is you are considering a perturbation of the system. This is the change in the action, which is given by ddx, let's say some operator, and the corresponding source for that operator. Okay. So then you are interested in how does the expectation value of this operator change if you are changing this external source, right? So again, you can think about, I don't know, in our case, gravitational field and the energy momentum tensor. So the source of the change of the change in the energy momentum tensor will be the gravitational field. So this will look like T mu nu delta G mu nu or something like that, or something, right? So this is precisely what we are doing here. So then the statement is this delta of expectation value of this operator, and let me do it in the Fourier space where it's actually super simple. Okay, so now if you want to find the response of the system to this external perturbation, phi zero, how does it change your expectation value of the operator O? Then it's given by beautiful formula. This is given by is a retarded Green function of the operator OO. It will depend on quantitatively on this operator O, K, and then phi zero K. So this is this beautiful linear relation between the response of the system to the external source perturbation, okay? And this is the Green function. Yes?
Is the Green function computed with the new Lagrangian, with the perturbation?
Ah, very good. So this So everything here is calculated using just row zero, right? So all the averages and everything, it's a linear response theory. You are calculating. So the only perturbation is sort of encoded here. It's amazing. So, but it's only because you are going to the linear order in perturbation. If you go to higher orders, of course there will be back reaction, and you will have to change everything. But this is just the simplest, lowest order of perturbation you can think about. All right. So very good. So let's apply this theory. So you know, I have you seen this? No. Okay. Read books about linear perturbation theory, linear response theory. Okay, so for us, it means that the delta of the expectation value of tau xy will be given by this minus g retarded Green function of k, and then the external source, which is inducing the variation in tau, is the gravitational field, right? Zero of k. Okay. So this is the microscopic theory, but what we are now doing the expectation value, right? So if I call this relation 1, and you have derived it in your tutorial, and compared it with this relation 2, which comes from the linear response theory, but it's really like microscopically you are doing something, you are doing really the Q of t calculation here, right? So comparing 1 and 2 gives an amazing formula for eta, right? So I have delta tau xy is the same, so you are finding that the eta is given by 1 over I omega, the retarded Green function. I hope the minus sign is right. Okay. So if we can calculate this Green function here, then we know what eta is. Okay. Things like this are called Kubo formula. Maybe if you've done some condensed matter things and whatever. So this is a Kubo relation. And that tells you how to relate microscopic physics through the retarded Green functions and stuff like that to the macroscopic physics, to real observables in your hydrodynamics theory and stuff like that. Yes?
Just based off of that statement,
yes.
Usually relations between microscopic objects and macroscopic objects are coming through some sort of averages.
Like okay, yeah, precisely. Yeah.
Here on the right side, we just have the Green's function, and I find that surprising that that's basically the same thing as the viscosity. Like without some sort of like...
Precisely. So you are doing the average here, right? So you are doing delta of the expectation value or of the average. And somehow this is indeed given to the linear order by the Green function. But you know, this is just nothing else than what we have done in classical physics, right? We have the source. When we study the Maxwell equations, this is the source, right? This is the source, that's the Green function, and that gives us the electromagnetic field, right? So you're doing exactly the same thing as you are doing in the... Anyway. So this is it. So now what is also true is that the microscopic theory gives you how this Green function looks like, right? And the Green function is the retarded Green function as you know it from the QFT is given by the expectation value of the commutator. So where, and this is in the key space, K space, the GK is something like an integral to pi kx, and then it will be an expectation value of tau xy, let's say x tau xy 0, and there will be a commutator here, and this is what it is, okay? So it's a Fourier transform of an expectation value of the commutator of the corresponding energy momentum tensor, okay?
I'm sorry, Dave. Why is there a commutator?
Sorry?
Why is there a commutator there?
It's a retarded green function. There should be a commutator, I think. Is that true? Probably true. Anyway, some kind of green function. Yeah. Anyway, what is important for us is that what it is really is an expectation value of two-point function. So we have tau tau here, and we are calculating the expectation value. Okay? So now, so far here, step one and two has nothing to do with ADS-CFT, right? This is just we are trying to calculate something in the Heiter regime, right? And we are using some microscopic quantum field theory to tell you how the properties of the hydro fluid are related to the microscopics. So far, no ADS-CFT, right? So far, everything is like as you would expect. So now, let's do the ADS-CFT. So step three is to employ ADS-CFT. And how you do that is that you say, of course, our fluid lives on the boundary, right? So this is dz equal to 0 or z equal to epsilon fluid. We have the quark gluon plasma here, right? We are putting this in some non-trivial background, gamma mu nu, but the gamma mu nu was the flat metric plus this hxy perturbation, right? So there will be some like perturbation of the metric. So there will be, let's just write hxy 0 as a perturbation of the flat metric which we are putting our plasma on, okay? Okay, very good. So now we relay this through the ADS-CFT to the bulk calculation, right? So this is a strongly coupled plasma, living in the space-time. So now we add the bulk here. And of course, we want quark-gluon plasma to be very, very high temperature. So we want a black hole there. We want this to be, flat Minkowski space in the Poincaré, whatever, so we will have a black brain. All right, so this is our black brain, okay? And that black brain provides us the temperature for the temperature of quark-gluon plasma. But of course, if the black brain is whatever you know, Schwarzschild ADS-4, which is what we derived last time, right? The Schwarzschild ADS black hole is a zero law of thermodynamics tell you that the temperature is the same on the horizon, right? So if you have like equilibrium black hole, then it's the same temperature. So the temperature coming from there's no change over the horizon. So there will be everywhere will be the same temperature here. We cannot have that, right? We have to go out of the equilibrium. We have to go into the hydro regime. So what you are really doing is that you are perturbing this black brain, sort of. So that we can have some perturbation here as well, so that there's a space varying temperature, space varying. So there's something interesting. So this is a non-uniform black brain here. Okay, and so of course, what will happen is that we now will give a physical interpretation of this perturbation hxy, that will simply correspond. So this guy here will be the boundary value of a perturbation of gravitational field in the bulk of this black brain spacetime. Okay, so here in the spacetime here we have instead of g mu nu we go to g mu nu plus a perturbation where this is the ADS Schwarzschild ADS 5. Okay, so that's the background, and this is the perturbation. And the perturbation, of course, what we want is that on the boundary, this h mu nu on the boundary, ADS, is precisely this hxy0, right? So that's what we want, and we just have to study the gravitational perturbation of our Schwarzschild spacetime, right? Such that on the boundary it reduces precisely to the perturbation which we want, and once we have that, we can calculate the expectation value of the T mu nu, right? And we have a dictionary for that. We know what we have to do, right? So remember, when we are calculating, we need to calculate something like two-point function, tau xy, right? So it's a two-point function. Okay, how do we do that? It's very simple, right? What we have to do is that we have to find out the equations of motion for our perturbation. Okay, so this has to be on shell. So there will be something like, so you start with the Einstein-Hilbert action. You plug in g mu nu plus h mu nu. You linearize the action, right? And you find a quadratic correction to the background, which will depend quadratically on h mu nu, on this perturbation. This is your action governing this perturbation. Okay, so now this is your action you start working with. You write down the equations of motion. You solve for the perturbation, right? You express it in terms of the boundary data. And then once you have a solution in terms of the boundary data, you plug it back to the action, and you have your Hamilton's function for the perturbation, right? So we solve equations of motion. So that's precisely what we were discussing like last week, how to calculate two-point correlation functions, right? We solve equations of motion for perturbation h mu nu. Okay. Express this in terms of the boundary value problem, the boundary h x y 0, and plug to action governing the h mu nu perturbation. So we get the Hamilton's function, which will now depend on this boundary value of the perturbation. Right, so this is what, so that's our Hamilton's function, and once we have that, we know that this is precisely what gives us the generating function for the correlation functions. So now this guy here is by ADS CFT given by this hxy zero here, right? And so then we can calculate the expectation value tau xy. Tau xy s minus d square s h xy 0 divided by delta h 0 xy delta h 0 xy. So that was the prescription, right? Which we seen last time. So is this clear? So this is like super nice, right? So you're just giving a new twist to all this. So it's clear what you have to do on the QFT side, right? So you're just using this, you know, microscopic linear response theory to relate Green's function, so some kind of two-point function to your shear viscosity. But the ADS CFT thing gives you a way how you can calculate this two-point function, tau xy. And how you do that, you know that tau mu nu is sourced by the metric, right? So you just study a perturbation, metric perturbation in the bulk. It's a simple calculation, something people have been doing from 50s or 60s last year, right? Perturbing black holes, right? And so, but the only thing is that you require that the perturbation looks somehow as you want on the boundary, right? And then you just evaluate your action for the perturbation in terms of this boundary data. And that's precisely what gives you the generating function for your correlation thing. Okay, so now to do this explicitly, it's some gravitational calculation which you have to do. You really have to study the perturbation, and that takes a couple of hours, I think. But anyway, so what the result is, and I am way over time, So result of calculation is that you find that this g of k and omega, we are taking really limit that the spatial momentum are zero, is minus pi nc square t cube divided by 8 I omega. And I don't know why there's a minus. I'm missing some of the minus, so okay. Anyway, so this is the result. Something like this. So now you use this formula 3, okay? Formula 3. This is formula 3 to calculate the shear viscosity, right? And so you just divide by I omega, and this is minus. Let's delete the minus. Doesn't matter. Okay, I think there should be minus there, but it doesn't matter. So anyway, you just delete I omega, and this is what your eta is, right? So this thing here is your eta. Okay, so you calculated eta. Your quark-gluon plasma is super, super hot. So T is huge. So this is a huge viscosity. However, you have also shown in your tutorial 5 that the entropy density, and just look at the results in your tutorial, is nc square t cube. Okay, so see tutorial 5. You have calculated this. So now if you do the ratio of eta over s, miracle, miracle, you find 1 over 4 pi. So this is how you do the calculation. Isn't this amazing? Super simple, right?
So we calculate the Green's function using the two-point correlation function, and then we equate it to I omega eta, because, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we get the Green's function as a function of t cube times I omega just from the two-point correlation function? Because the action does not know about...
No, but it will depend on the properties of the black brain, right? So certainly it depends on the properties like radius of the black brain. But then you can relate the radius of the black brain to the temperature, as you have done in your tutorial, right? So it's precisely what you have been doing in your tutorial, how to relate the properties of the black brain to the properties of the CFT, you will be doing again here, right? And sort of this I omega, it never enters anything, right? So you can forget about the I omega. This is in the limit where, you know, sort of, anyway, you are interested in the hydro limit where omega sort of goes to zero and k goes to zero, but it, you know, it's always divided by these things. So
the action knows about the temperature and omega as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the omega comes from the Fourier transform, right? But the action definitely knows about the temperature and everything. Yes.
It's really cool, but I'm a bit confused by the setup. Like the first setup.
Yes.
I guess my confusion is about like what are the theories that we were working in? On the left side we have some quark-gluon plasma, and you said it was measured at the LHC, and it came very close to this calculation.
Yeah.
But and on the other side, the dualities between ADS5 cross S5 and n equals 4. Like, why does it come so close to working?
It's a very good question, right? But people try to go, like, you know, so here you have sort of like, of course, you know, you should be doing some kind of supergravity here. So what people did, like the first calculation was they used Einstein ADS space-time, right? So just normal gravity without any other thing. And then people try to go beyond that, and they try various theories, and surprise, surprise, you always get something like 1 over 4 pi. So it seems very, very robust calculation.
I guess my confusion is about if you take just a generic quantum field theory on the boundary, it's not necessarily true that you'll find a holographic description that is governed by Einstein's equations. So if I take a quark-gluon plasma from somewhere, it does not necessarily mean that I've got a black brain and so on.
Yeah. No, I agree. No, it's very good. No, it's very good that you're asking this question. It's very good to be cautious. So somehow this gives, you know, qualitatively very, you know, robust and you know, results. But the question is this quantitatively right for really our quark-gluon plasma or something like that? And you know, that's not guaranteed, right? Because you are going well beyond the the ADS CFT and stuff like that. But you know, this is very, very robust result. So you can consider different gravitational theories and stuff like that. And then you know, people are always getting something like 1/4 pi. Except Rob Myers designed a theory where actually you can break this 1/4 pi and can get even lower, right? But it's a crazy theory which is unstable and it's like it's a forced derivative theory. Anyway, okay. So you know what people think is that this is like a lower bound for fluid viscosity, and they believe that that actually you know you can never go like any real fluid will always have this ratio bigger than 1/4 pi. Okay.
Is there any other like theoretical way to calculate this without ADS CFT, or is it just the only?
I have no. My suspicion is that not really. But I'm not an expert on the QFT calculation, so you have to ask somebody. Ask Davide; he may know. Yeah. And so what it also means that quark gluon plasma is almost ideal fluid. Okay. Yes.
From another point of view, the quark is a strongly equality, and the quark gluon plasma is in the regime of very strongly why is it that the over S being very small corresponds to strong correlation? Because last time you said that if you have a weakly interacting fluid, the 8/S value would be gigantic, like 10 to the.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why is this regime an 8/S?
Okay. Okay. It's something you can sort of also expect for you know from weakly coupled things. I'll give you some estimate. Just maybe after the lecture, please remember this question, and I can give you that you know some motivation for weakly coupled things that it will be huge. Yeah. But you know it's something that can be justified. Okay. So now next lecture, Bruno will tell you about. He will show you an amazing derivation. For the entanglement entropy and stuff like that. And we will use in the end of this course to, you know, the entanglement entropy to tell you something about the black hole information paradox. So we are heading back towards black holes and black hole information paradox, but for that we are going to use the entanglement entropy calculation. So let me just, in the 10 minutes, tell you something about, like, introduce this topic. So holographic. Entanglement entropy. Okay, and so we know that if we have quantum mechanics, we can introduce von Neumann entropy. So there's a von Neumann entropy. So this will be a repetition, I think, for everybody here. But let's just set the stage. And so S for Neumann, if you have your system described by the density matrix rho, is just minus 3 trace rho log rho. Okay. And this thing here will be 0 for pure state. And it will be maximal for, you know, if you have equal probabilities of anything happening. So for equal probability distribution. So if you have no knowledge about anything, then this thing here will be maximal. Okay, so now we have the Von Neumann entropy. But you can also calculate the entanglement entropy. So let's assume that our Hilbert space is simply a product of Aj, Hb. And so we have two subsystems, A and B, subsystems. And then you can calculate the reduced density matrix. So for example, what A sees if they don't know, if they don't have access to B, right? And so there's a reduced density matrix is it a matrix for A, and that will be given by row A. Simply you don't have access to what's happening in B, so you trace over B of the density row, here. And then you can calculate the entanglement entropy. Which will be the Feu-Neumann entropy of this reduced density matrix, as A is minus trace. Now we are tracing over the rest, row A log row A. Okay, so that's the entanglement entropy, and it somehow measures how the system A is entangled or correlated with system B. Okay, and so really, you know, people like Eduardo will tell you, well, this really measures entanglement only when you are, and the whole thing is in the pure state and stuff like that. Yeah, so we will always have pure state, so it's okay. So now, what is true is that if you have pure state, then SA equals to SB, so there's the same correlation between A and B if viewed from both sides, that makes sense. So this is pure state, but we always assume pure state. Like the global state is pure, okay? Of course, that doesn't mean that row A is necessarily pure state. And there is a miraculous property, which I don't know if you've shown in one of the courses. It's just called subadditivity. Subadditivity property. And that tells you that if you have two regions, A and B, and you sum the entanglement entropies of SA plus SB, then this is greater or equal than SA unified B and SA, how is that called, at the same time B. Okay. And so what this sort of tells you is that the mutual information is monotonic in the region size, okay? So have you shown this in one of your courses? Or it's difficult to show. Right? So if you, it's true, but very, very difficult to prove. Okay. Very good. So that's what's happening in quantum mechanics. Right? So now what happens in the quantum field theory? Right? So in the quantum field theory, we can still say, well, okay, so let's consider my quantum field theory. Let's look at some t equal to constant slice, and let's have some region A in that spatial region, and let's ask, you know, how this region A is entangled with the rest of the system. Okay, so now I mean, what you are saying, see, well, you can have an intersection still, right?
HA tensor HB tensor HC, and you do AB, BC, and B is the intersection.
Well, that is the statement about the regions, right? That is the statement about the Hilbert spaces. So in QFT, this is a disaster. So we will have fixed time. So we'll have fixed t equal to t0. Okay, and then we have some, you know, region. So this is our QFT at t equal to t0. And let's say we have the region A here. And you may be interested again, you know, how the entanglement entropy is between the region A and the rest of the system, right? And I have absolutely no idea how this is calculated on the QFT side. But what you find is that this S of A is given by, you know, something, some constant, which is characteristic for your system, and then lambda d minus 2 plus the subleading terms. So there will be some other r lambda d minus 3, and then you can have some logarithmic terms as well. So where r is the size, characteristic size of A, size of A. So it's a linear size of A, and lambda is the UV cutoff. Okay, so this is what happens in the QFT. And now if you look at this thing here, what is amazing is that the leading term has R d minus 2. Okay, so now what we are doing, right? So this is our QFT, which lives in d-dimensional space. So this region here is at t equal to t0 constant. So this slice is d minus 1 dimensional. D minus 1 dimensional slice. Okay. So the region A is d minus 1 dimensional. Right? But what the statement is that the entanglement entropy does not go like d minus 1 dimensional thing, does not go like the volume of the region A, but rather goes like d minus 2. It goes like the area of the dA. Okay, so this thing here will have dA, which is precisely d minus 2 dimensional. Okay, and so what we are finding is that really this SA, so the leading order, goes like the area of dA. And of course, there is some divergence. Times infinity plus the subleading terms, right? But really, somehow, what is important for the entanglement entropy is rather the area of the bounding region of the boundary of the region A, not the dimensionality of A. But it sort of makes sense. Like, if you want to calculate, you know, entanglement between this point and that point, well, they are very, very far away, so maybe the entanglement is small. So the huge contribution for the entanglement will come from the nearby region close to the boundary, right? And so that's an intuitive reason as to why you might think that actually the entanglement rather goes like the area of the boundary rather than the area of the region A. Okay. Very good. So this is what's happening in the QFT. And as I say, I have no idea how this is calculated. But now how this is calculated in ADS-CFT. Okay. So now ADS-CFT prescription. ADS-CFT prescription for calculating SA is due to Ryu and Takayanagi. And the prescription is super simple. So again, we have this thing here. That's our t equal to constant slice. That is our region A. Okay. Now we place this on the boundary of the ADS, as always. So this will correspond to z equal to 0 or z equal to epsilon. And so this is the z equal to epsilon, let's say we introduce the cutoff here, close to the z equal to 0. And then there will be bulk spacetime, so there will be ADS spacetime here, right? And then what thing you can calculate in the ADS space so that it's somehow related to this region A? Well, again, what you can do is that you can calculate minimal surface which goes from this region A to the bulk. So you can calculate something like this, which extends to the bulk. So there will be some gamma here, which is the surface of this thing, which is anchored on the boundary of A. So this is the dA, and you know this thing here is anchored simply here, and then you are interested in the minimal surface gamma, so that it's anchored on this thing here. So the prescription is as follows. So you calculate the entanglement entropy for the region A as the minimum among all gamma which are homologous to the region A, which means they can be smoothly deformed to A, right? So you're interested in any bubbles which extend like this to the thing, which can be smoothly deformed to the region A. Okay, so this minimum gamma over A and its area of the gamma divided by 4g d plus 1. Okay? So that's the prescription how to calculate this entanglement entropy over here. And what you will find is that if you actually do calculate these things, you will find that precisely you are getting results like this. Okay, so this agrees with what is expected. And in particular, again, you find that the leading order contribution here will be given by the area of dA. Yes?
Do we know if, so there are two divergences, one coming from the entropy and one coming from the geometrical divergence? So,
and they match.
Yeah, they match?
They match. Yeah, exactly. So that precisely. So, you know, as you are going here, you know, to the boundary of ADS, of course, it's infinite, right? So as you are approaching z equal to zero, this is infinite. It's precisely the divergence, which will be corresponding to this UV cutoff here. Yeah, so basically what you can do is that you can set this epsilon to be 1 over lambda or something like that. And that's precisely what's happening. OK. Sorry, I want to show you one more thing. But it will be 2 minutes, I promise. So now I told you there's this beautiful sub-additivity property for the entanglement entropy, which is difficult to prove in the quantum information context. OK. So let me now show you that in this holographic context, it's a piece of cake. Okay? So, so sub-additivity be hard to prove in quantum information context. But in holographic context, what are we doing, right? This is our boundary at z equal to epsilon. We have region A is this thing here. We have region B is this thing here. That's the region B. Okay, let's do it like that. That's the region B. Now, SA is given by the minimal surface going like this. So this is d gamma A, right? SB is this thing here, gamma B. Very good. So now we want to calculate S gamma A plus S gamma B. So we basically have to add this thing here plus that thing there, right? Getting this plus that. How do we do it? We can do it that we are adding this plus that, right? So this is equal to this plus that. You agree? What else it will be, right? But very good. But what is this thing here? It's A unified with B. So this is A unified with B. It's this region here. right? And this region here is AB. Okay. But now look at that. So now if I want to calculate the entanglement entropy for A unified with B, I have to take a minimal surface, which spans, you know, this region here. Okay? Let's say it will be to a surface like this. This will be gamma A unified with B. But that's a minimal surface. So this thing here has to be bigger than that. Okay, so this thing here is bigger or equal than gamma unified with B. So now I have A, how do you say this? Like that. So this will be the minimal surface, K, A and B. Okay. But this has to be smaller or equal than that. Right? And so you just prove it. Right? So you have that S of A plus S of B, which is this and that, which is this plus that, is bigger or equal than S A B plus S A B. And you showed it. Isn't that amazing? Okay, so let me stop here, and then Bruno will tell you how to formulate this thing here covariantly. So far we are choosing t equal to constant slice, but and everything was like we had the static space time and stuff like that. It can be done in for time dependent situations, and Bruno will tell you about that. He will tell you that we are finding the minimal surface, but more generally, if you allow time to varying, you will have to be finding extremal surfaces, not necessarily minimal surfaces, but extremal surfaces. In fact, surfaces which are minimal in the spatial direction and maximal in the time direction. Right? And so that's what Bruno will tell you, and he will prove you some interesting results.